Wrestling promoter throughout North America. I kick every one of their asses.
The fraud, the messer with me.
In a court of law, I took on the United States of America and I kicked her ass. I took on WCW and it took me a while, but I kicked their asses. Mr. McMahon, what's your secret? More than any one quality that makes me the successful man that I am, ruthless aggression. So I want to know here tonight, as you stand here on my ring, which one of you has that quality? Who among you has that one single ingredient? Who has enough ruthless aggression?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
No info for the DEA, federal agents, man.
North South Connection, welcome again to another episode of the Ruthlessly Aggressive Podcast. It's good to be back here. It's a pay-per-view night. I'm braving some tropical weather that I just endured. Yesterday, I got electricity back at my home for the first time in about 7 days, so I'm over the moon, but I would not let that stop me from recording this podcast. And this is a big show. Definitely a transitional show, as we are really getting into the transitional period and really getting into what I would call the true ruthless aggression period, as we're going to see very soon. But since this is King of the Ring, I have brought in a guest who lives in an area where people still respect kings and queens and monarchies, and that is Mr. Ben Locke. How you doing, Ben?
Jacob, yeah, we still respect things like monarchies and elections and things like that. sorry. Let's not mention that. Yeah, we're here to talk some wrestling.
Yeah, by the time this drops, hopefully we'll know how that shakes out. So I don't want to put the mush on anything, but yeah, that's kind of a lame segue. But it wasn't very creative, but that's the best I can do. I'm not a very creative person. But how are you, Ben?
I'm good, mate. I'm good. Much like our election back in December, you guys are having to pick the lesser of two evils, so we really can't say anything about that. Whichever one you pick.
Exactly. So, Ben, this is actually, we do quite a few. We do podcasts together. We do, of course, Highway to the Impact Zone over on the Blaze TV Nation Wrestling feed. But you've never been on this show, actually. And this is sort of a similar era as our TNA podcast that we do together from time to time. But since this is your first time, it is customary on this show when I have a first-time guest, I will ask you, where were you in 2002? Where were you at as a wrestling fan? Were you watching WWE constantly? And since this is a pay-per-view, do you remember watching the show at the time?
So 2002, I was thinking about this today. I was kind of on the wane a little because, you know, obviously I don't know if you know our education system in this country. So you go from school, you go to college, and then you go to university. So college for me, so I'm nearly 40 now. So college was 97 to 2000, so that was right in the middle of Attitude. You know, we'd have like, even on a Sunday night, Monday morning for us, we'd have 15-20 people at house parties watching the pay-per-views. By this stage, because I'd moved on to university, you know, we were sort of down into the single figures. You know, we were lucky if we got five. So I was definitely still watching. I was you know, I think I've said this on other pods, I was a fan watching constantly till about 2004, 2005, did that thing, you know, met a girl, wasn't as lucky to get a girl who's even slightly into wrestling. So it was a case of just watching what I could, when I could, that kind of thing. But I definitely, we got our pay-per-views for free over here until about 2010, I want to say.
Wow.
So I do remember seeing this show. I definitely saw this show.
So it kind of sounds like, because I've mentioned it on the previous shows, that they're going into, it's hard to say, a downturn, as it were. We're not talking about, like, you know, they're in any danger of going out of business. They're still cranking it out and making a lot of money, I would say, at this point. But it is sort of, business is not where it was at one point. And it kind of sounds like, from what you're saying, it's sort of like their popularity is starting to wane just a little bit. And you're kind of reaching that point where a lot of people sort of dip out a little bit. So kind of like a little bit of a perfect storm for things to maybe not be as locked in. No pun intended.
I think that's very good. I think that's a very fair comment. Like, the year before 2001 in the summer, I was in Australia. So I missed the whole of the invasion angle. I missed the whole of it pretty much until the last couple of months. Yeah, and then obviously, you know, you get into new friendship groups, don't you? And, you know, are they necessarily wrestling fans? No, they're not. So, you know, you're getting into drink, you're getting into drugs, you're getting into, you know, I know that sounds, it sounds bad to say it like that, but, you know, you were sort of, you know, learning things about your life and just changing things. So, but I was still watching, so I don't want it to make it sound like I wasn't being a fan. I was still watching, so I would say from King of this pay-per-view to WrestleMania 19, particularly on the SmackDown side, I was, you know, fully locked in. You could say what, you know, I know you, when you get there, you can say what you want about Katie Vick, but at least it was memorable, you know, that compared to some of the stuff that we're seeing today, for example, at least it was memorable stuff. Might not have been the best, but, you know, it's something you're going to remember.
Yeah. And I think it's indicative. This is a very good show, because I feel like, I had never really thought about it until I really started doing this deep dive through this era and really kind of picking the weekly TV apart. And I never really realized that it was this quick after Austin leaves, because he's only been gone a few weeks at this point.
Yeah.
How quickly things sort of turn and they really go hard into sort of a new era here, to the point where Vince is even kind of pushing it himself as the character Vince, pushing that this is a new era. And I think this is sort of a show that really bridges the gap for better or for worse in certain aspects as we move on.
I'm definitely, like, you know, Steve Austin is my number one of all time, you know, by a country mile. But I know you guys mentioned it with Sean and Lewis, but it was definitely the right time for him to go. You know, he was burnt out. Yeah, I don't know how much the Eddie feud would have kept him going. He was running on fumes. He needed that 6 months off to recharge his batteries, frankly.
Yeah, great. But it definitely shows in this show that we're moving into something totally new. But on that note, I don't really have any news and notes, because kind of this is in the same week as the last show when we covered Raw and SmackDown. So it's really, I kind of cover a week of Meltzer's news at a time. So I really don't have anything. So we're just going to focus on the show, which is, of course, King of the Ring 2002. We are live from Columbus, Ohio, and this is actually their first sellout. Not that they've had a ton of pay-per-views in between. It's only been like two or three shows, but this is their first sellout since WrestleMania 18. So big show. I think the crowd is about 15,000. So again, when I say business is maybe a little bit on the downturn, we're not talking about, you know, they're going out of business. Just maybe not what it was a year or so ago, but it's surely, you know, they're not. They're still firmly in the black, I would say.
You could tell this was a packed crowd, and, you know, for certain points of the night, they were really into things as well.
Yep. So we get a nice opening package. I really kind of enjoyed this package that they did to open it, kind of highlighting the past winners. And I kind of thought it was funny, because at first you sort of think they're going to go through everybody, because it wouldn't take a long time, because it's still not even, you know, really 10 years that they've been doing King of the Ring as a pay-per-view. But so I'm thinking they're going to show everybody, but there were some convenient, conspicuous absences as to the past winners they chose not to highlight. Like, notice Billy Gunn did not get a moment in this video package.
There was no King Mabel, damn it.
They seem to focus mainly on the Hearts and, you know, your bigger name guys, then
But I made a note that yeah, I thought it was a really good video package as well. Like, particularly as you know, it's the last, you know, in obviously 2020, we know it's the last King of the Ring pay per view. So as a historical package, I thought it was really good. Like you say, they could have just had a quick, you know, 2-3 seconds, 95 maybe. You don't even need to go into too much detail, and you can still do the same thing, you know, that hit the big stuff like the Hearts and the Austin interview. Mm-hmm. And you if you cut it out, it's fine because it's their history and all that.
Yeah, and the big point that they try and hammer home in the package too is King of the Ring as sort of a stepping stone, which is very relevant to what's going to happen on this show, and especially given that they've added the stipulation that the winner is going to get a number one contender spot at SummerSlam, which is sort of a new concept. And again, is kind of Vince putting on the table that this is sort of a big stepping, like this is a transition, that whoever wins this King of the Ring is going to get a big opportunity that the King of the Ring does not always get. So interesting. But to open things up, we have our first King of the Ring semifinal match, which will be Chris Jericho versus RVD, which is definitely a nice choice for an opener on paper for sure. Because these are obviously two guys who can go if given some time, given a little bit of a spot. Hard to pick two better guys to have in the opener, so I thought that was a good choice. I really like Rob's tights here. I thought they were awesome. He has the kind of the tiger stripe singlet on, and the crowd is firmly behind RVD. Pretty clear face heel demarcation here, as Jericho is pretty heavily ensconced as a heel at this point. Any thoughts just on the match on paper and coming into it, and this is sort of our opening semifinal match, Ben?
You knew out the two semifinals, this was going to be the match, the better of the two. And given the matches you had on the card, you also knew if it was given time that this would be one of the better matches on the show. Because, you know, here's a hot take for you. In 2002, Rob Van Dam's probably the most over man in the company, mm-hmm. even in, still in 2002. Because mm-hmm. the crowd absolutely loved him here.
Yeah, and he's still pretty damn good in the ring. I know, I think the consensus is kind of like 2001 is maybe his peak, but he has really been in ring one of the highlights of this podcast so far. He just seems to pull out. He hasn't had anything that I would call like all time. Like, I don't think I've had him in anything above like 4 stars, but he consistently brings like good to very good matches pretty much anytime he's in any kind of spot of relevance. But
you know, you say it's like about 3 months later he gets the sort of his legs chopped out, doesn't he, really?
Yeah.
So, won't spoil things, but what comes up in the next couple of months, it's only mm-hmm. really when you get to that Unforgiven time period where you think, yeah, maybe they haven't got plans for him after all.
Yeah, and he is, we should mention, he is obviously still the Intercontinental Champion after winning it from Eddie. So that's an interesting sort of caveat to this, too, that he is IC champ in this tournament. So we start off, I thought the opening spots of this were a little bit sloppy with the wrist locks and headlocks. They looked a little bit out of sync in that very early going when they're kind of doing the feeling out stuff, but then they do sort of a kind of what you see that some people are not a big fan of, but I thought it was okay here. I don't think it looked overly done here, but they kind of do the stare down after kind of feeling each other out, and they do like a dueling dropkick spot. The common thing to put over that they're sort of evenly matched and they sort of do the stare down. I didn't mind it here. I know some people are not a big fan of that kind of stuff, but I didn't mind it. And so we continue. Jericho survives RVD's early onslaught. He gets dumped outside the ring, and then RVD hits a huge plancha that looked really nice. That was a nice spot. We get a nice heel spot as they work their way back in, where Jericho actually kicks the refs. So RVD goes up for the 5-star, and Jericho actually kind of boots the ref into the ropes, which kind of makes RVD fall. So I thought that was a good creative heel spot and a good creative ref bump, to have him actually kind of behind the ref's back, sort of pop the ref in the butt and shoot him into the ropes. I thought it was good. Kind of changes the momentum
As we change the momentum again, as RVD manages kind of a cool, unique pinning combo where he hooks Jericho's ankles with his feet. I thought that was pretty good. Jericho works his way back on top and he unties the turnbuckle, which is watching these shows that I don't know if there's somebody in the back coming up with this, but I feel like in every single kind of any match with any kind of heel that's worth anything, they're always trying to untie the fucking turnbuckle. Like, it's like in every match, the heel has to untie the turnbuckle. It's so
it's
like
it's a page A to the heel manual. This is what you must do.
Yeah. Jericho, Taker, they're just like constantly going for it, which is not one of my favorite things, because to me, it never looks like super intimidating what's underneath the buckle. It's just like one little metal ring. So I imagine it would hurt more than the turnbuckle, but it's never something that as a wrestling fan has really like made a ton of sense to me. I mean, I get it's wrestling. It's just one of those things you got to accept, but it doesn't carry much weight for me because it just always looks like you can barely see the steel ring there. So, but anyway, so he unties the turnbuckle, which delays the count on the cradle by RVD. RVD hits a roll up and the ref has dealing with the stupid turnbuckle. Jericho misses, kind of, he goes for the leapfrog sort of guillotine move, but he finds a way to grind his knee into RVD's back. RVD works out of it. And then Jericho throws him into the ring post. We get a series of kicks as RVD starts working his comeback. Now we get a good series of kicks from both guys that leaves Jericho on top. That was nice. Just a lot of this was a lot of them sort of being evenly matching, going back and forth, but in a good way. I think sometimes stuff like that can sort of feel like, they're just trading spots. But here I thought they did a good job of transitioning from one guy's momentum to the next. And RVD, I think, is a really good face underneath. And his moveset, I think, is really apt to a nice comeback because he can kind of pull out some crazy move and work his way in. We get a German release for a near fall for Chris Jericho. RVD drops Jericho on the ropes, and he does his split moonsault, his signature moonsault where he kind of springboards and does the split off. That gets another near fall. Jericho goes for the walls, but then he gets rolled up. I thought that was a really great near fall. Again, a lot of really cool sort of reversals and stuff in this match that made sense. We get another good spot as Jericho lands on the middle rope after the catapult. So RVD goes to catapult him, and Jericho kind of like kind of does a cat sort of thing and sort of lands on the middle rope and balances himself. Just tons of stuff like that. And I really enjoyed that throughout the match. Is that something you noticed, Ben, throughout this match?
Obviously with the way RVD's body is. So I made the note of the, like the old school version of the Wolves with that, the full bend of the body and the knees. So they could obviously use each other for counter wrestling. I don't know if they have faced each other before, but if they have, you can tell the spots they were working in. So, you mentioned the German suplex. So it was that great double arm superplex off the top that Jericho did. And I really enjoyed this. Really, really enjoyed this. This was one of those matches at the time and in my head I thought was good. But this, it nearly went up to very good / great for me. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
On the rewatch, I don't know how you felt.
Yeah. So we'll get into the finish and then because this did get a lot of time. It was a good 15-20 minute match. So
easy.
Yeah, a lot of time to it. So we get a near fall, like I said, where Jericho finally throws him into the exposed buckle. He used the ropes for the pinfall, classic heel stuff. Gets another near fall. He hits the bulldog, and then he misses the lion salt, which I've mentioned on previous shows that it's like I don't think he has the greatest success rate in the lion salt, but here he misses it. But it's almost like he knows he's going to miss it, so he lands on his feet. But he eats a spinning heel kick from RVD. RVD goes for the five star, but he misses it. So then Jericho does connect with the lion salt. We get RVD going for the Rana, but that gets him in the walls and puts him in the corner. So that was a cool spot too, where Jericho kind of caught him in a Hurricane Rana and then put him in the walls. But then he makes his way to the corner. They struggle in the corner. Jericho gets crotched, and then that allows for the five-star. Yeah, Jericho's in the corner. He kind of got – RVD hits the ropes, crotches Jericho. Finally hits the five-star frog splash for the win. I thought this was a really good match. We'll talk a second about the kind of, I guess, the, you know, the reputation of this matchup. I thought it was a really great opener. I thought it escalated really nicely. I like that Jericho found a way to kind of work an RVD sort of athletic, you know, match with all these kind of cool spots and stuff while still working in his heel stuff. I liked all the reversals. They didn't feel too contrived for me. And it was a good way to me, it made things transition well between who was on top and, you know, as the momentum swung from guy to guy, they really found cool ways to move from, you know, one person being on top to the next. I thought maybe near the end, they could have used a little more selling since it was such a long match and they had been hitting so much stuff and maybe sell just a little bit more. And then I thought the finish was maybe a bit flat compared to some of the other cool near falls that they pulled out preceding it. You know, just Jericho getting crushed and hitting the five star, I thought was a little anticlimactic considering what had come before it, you know. Jericho loses. I don't think it really hurts him. RVD is positioned really strong. He's the you know, Intercontinental champ, and this was one of those matches where I don't think either guy would have been hurt by losing it just because it came off as so competitive and either one could have won. I went 3 3/4 on it, Ben. I know it has sort of a reputation. To me, it kind of has that reputation of like Jericho himself sort of maybe overrated by saying it was this great thing at the time. And so the backlash to it was then people kind of crapped on a little bit. And I think maybe it's been underrated a bit over time. So I feel like I'm somewhere in the middle of that. So like, I think a lot of people would say it's more of a 3-star match. Jericho thought it was some all-time classic. I don't think it ever gets to that level, but still a really, really good match.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you. So if I remember what Jericho said at the time, I think he was like, it's some sort of 4.5, 5-star classic, which it isn't, but what it is a really, really good match. So I went 3.5 on it. Like you say, they weren't just using moves, and you know, there was counter moves. There was a whole flow to the match that worked beautifully. That sequence, like you say, with the two missed moonsaults and then the line salt, I thought was beautiful. I'm going to disagree with you slightly. I like the fact that it was such a simple ending. Mm-hmm. I can see where you're coming from with the whole, I'd like it in more intrinsic ending with like you say, with the whole misses that we're doing, but I like the fact that it just finished and it finished suddenly. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, RVD had gone for the 5-star at least twice before and missed it. Mm-hmm. This time, you know, it was a quick, sudden boom, I've hit it for the win. Yeah, 3.5. Like you say, I think people at the time, you know, from what Jericho was saying, they were trying to find any excuse to underplay it. Whereas now, you know, 18 years on, we will give it the, you know, the love it does deserve. Because 3.5 stars, it, you know, that's not a kick in the teeth. It's a bloody good match.
Yeah, for sure. And it sets the tone for the show. And, you know, credit to Jericho, too, because, you know, obviously RVD is known for all his kind of acrobatic stuff and everything. But Jericho definitely hung with up with that, too. Jericho can definitely do that kind of stuff. Like, he had plenty of spots in here where he showed off his own kind of balance and flexibility. Like the spot we mentioned where he gets catapulted and then sort of lands on the middle rope. I thought that was a super cool fall. And I think Jericho, when he's going for it, is really good at this type of stuff. I think he can come up with really creative spots and stuff. And I think this was a showcase for that.
Yeah, I think after the whole Triple H thing in the first half of the year, he was quite happy and glad to have a dance partner who, like you say, you know, he could do all these crazy athletic moves with and, you know, add new moves to his own repertoire.
Yeah. Did it bother you at all that he took the pin here? Because I know sort of a thing during this period is, you know, he gets kind of jobbed out because he loses to Triple H multiple times and he loses here. Did it bother you at all that he's losing here?
No, because even in 2002, he's become bulletproof, hasn't he?
Mm-hmm.
Even by this stage. So no, he did out. Because if you look at it, out the four guys, because I even made the note for this match, you know, the SmackDown competitors, that half of the tournament was particularly dreadful. It should have been the final that we got. So I had absolutely no problem with him taking the pin here.
Yeah, and you're kind of trapped when you're doing a tournament like this because it's of two minds. It's either you have to do this and do like a screwy finish, if you're going to have two legit guys and you don't want one to lose, or else then you have to have two guys and one's completely overmatched, and you're not going to get probably the level of match that we got here. So it's kind of like you have to you have to make some kind of sacrifice in order to make the tournament, you know, get somewhere, you know.
Yeah, because this tournament, it was obvious at the time who was going to win it, so they had to, but they had to put some sort of mystique and intrigue in it. You know, it reminded me a lot of the 2000 tournament that Kurt won. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody, even with the level of competition that was in that tournament, knew that Kurt was going to be the guy. Mm-hmm. So there was that 2000. It reminded me of that and the 96 tournament as well, which I know was the one Austin won, but going in, everybody thought Vader was going to win.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we kind of have a pretty solid Final Four because these are obviously two high-tier guys. But anyway, so after the match, RVD stays in the ring. And to me, this was very telegraphed just by the way they were shooting. It was just very – like the way they did it is not the normal way that they would give interviews after a match with him in the ring. And they shot it like – where like it was really a really low shot where you couldn't see behind him. So you're like, okay, somebody's going to sneak up on him. RVD says he doesn't care who he has to face, dude. It could be Godzilla. He's going to be the king of the ring. And so, of course, Jericho comes up behind him and attacks him. Like I said, very telegraphed, but he gets locked in the walls of Jericho for insult to injury. And, of course, to put a little bit of, you know, babyface injury on him as he goes into the King of the Ring final, which was fine enough. It was just they definitely telegraphed it with that kind of the weird way they shot it.
And the fact that the King was doing the interview and he never does interviews. What's he doing there?
Yeah, everything was very odd. It was just not the way they King interviewing. It's in the ring. It's a weird low shot. You could tell something was going to happen. Yeah. So as this is happening, Heyman and Brock look on with pleasure, obviously, because they presuming that Brock will be facing RVD soon. Heyman compares Brock to Godzilla, but he says that unlike Godzilla, who is not real, Brock is real, and tonight he will become the King of the Ring. So a little bit of foreshadowing for our final that could be coming. But first, before that, Brock has to take on possibly, if we were to put the final four of this King of the Ring next to each other, it would be the one of these is not like the other, as he is going to face Test. Because our final four would be RVD, Chris Jericho, Brock Lesnar, and Test. So kind of an odd pairing, as this is sort of a heel-heel matchup here, which is always sort of can be interesting to see how the crowd's going to react to it. What are your feelings on Test? I'm not a big Test fan, admittedly.
Neither am I. So my first note for this was I called this the special foregone conclusion match. going back a few years, so I'm doing a chrono watch at the moment, and I'm just at the end of 99. So he's pretty much had his balls cut off from Steph and Triple H, and that's when they should have pulled the trigger on him, but they just never did it. And now they're trying to reheat him up again, and it's just not working again.
Yeah, it's just something's just kind of always missing for Tess, but it definitely comes off on paper as definitely a hoss match with Brock and Tess. We get a big hoss lockup to start, and the crowd is given the Goldberg chant. So you can see that the audience is not completely sold on Brock yet. And something I've spoke about, for the most part, they've done a pretty good job of building him up as this, as a monster and trying to set him apart. But I still think at the time, some people didn't see him as anything necessarily special, you know. And I think it's hard for us to look back with hindsight, knowing what he became when he was this early on. But, you know, a lot of people, you know, they did just think he was going to be Goldberg, you know, that he wasn't going to be much of a wrestler and that he was just another big jacked up guy. You know, and he hadn't really had any matches yet to kind of show off his arsenal and what he could do against somebody who could really wrestle. So, I mean, they definitely weren't sold on him. Not everybody was immediately sold on Brock, for sure.
Yeah, I got the note, though, that, you know, how much of the act, apart from the crowd reaction, they'd already got locked in. So after 3 months, so I know you mentioned on the last pod, he'd only just got the music, hadn't he? But just things like the in-ring mannerisms, the bounce when he's coming down to the ring, you know, he's got Heyman, he's got all the pieces have fell into place already. You know, they've got the the company already sold on his presence and his mystique and his physique and all that, but all the other little bits apart from that crowd reaction are there.
Yeah, and so part of what we're going to get into with this show is them now trying to make the booking of him, you know, trying to take him to the next level. Like you said, they have the presentation, the music, the look. He's got Heyman with him. You know, everybody talks like he's a big deal. It's like they're ready to take him to the next level.
Yeah, right? like you say that they're trying to convert him from the Goldberg clone into a guy who can wrestle the short match, but also. Mm-hmm. You know, can have those five-star classics that obviously we know we can have now. So they were pretty successful in doing that.
Yeah. So as they're chanting Goldberg, Test starts laying in some big clotheslines, kind of going with his typical Test offense, which is solid if limited for a big guy. So Brock he regroups outside with Heyman, but then he ends up getting worn out in the corner when he goes back in. And so really Test has taken a lot of the early offense in this, but then finally Brock takes advantage with the big spine buster. I thought I shit on King a lot. On this podcast, rightfully so, because he kind of sucks. But I thought at least like in this match, in the last match, he's been pretty good so far. Kind of calling the action and sort of being a little bit more, you know, calling in the ring as opposed to, you know, talking about other dumb shit that he does a lot of the time. And I thought he did a good job here, so I'll at least give him a little bit of credit here. So Brock starts wearing Test down finally, and then now anytime Test tries to make any attempt to come back, Brock's just cutting him off, which I thought was really good. Like Test tries to get back in, but he walks right into a sidewalk slam. But then Test finally. He starts making a little bit of a comeback. He does sort of a full Nelson slam that gets two for Test, sort of a near fall. And then Brock wiggles out. He goes for a pump handle slam, Test does, and Brock wiggles out of that at first, but then he eats it the second time and gets another near fall for Test. So a little surprising, like you said, they're not putting Test in here just as fodder because he's kind of getting his licks in on Brock, and Brock's selling for him a good amount. Test reverses a power bomb and hits a big boot. But in a big spot, Brock kicks out of the big boot, which is kind of at this point, Tess's sort of pseudo finisher. So it's pretty much him kicking out of Tess's finisher. Heyman comes in, distracts Test, and we get the F5. Before I get into mine, what did you think of this one, since we kind of laid out how the match was structured, Ben?
So I would have structured it a lot different. I'd have started the match from the moment he went for that big boot and missed it. Mm-hmm. You know, you basically had the RVD Jericho 15-20 minutes with RVD getting injured. If you want to make Brock into this killing machine, just have him squash Test, especially with it being a heel-heel match, have him squash Test in 2 minutes, and then he's the fresh man for the final. That tells the story there. As a match, though, I actually thought it was all right, but there was absolutely no need and no point for Test to go 50-50 with Brock Lesnar at this point. No point at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I sort of agree. It's a weird thing because it's like part of me is if I rate it as just a match, I thought it was a pretty solid big guy match, you know, because if you think, I guess Tess is sort of your de facto baby face in this compared to Brock, since Brock is, you know, a monster and he's got the heel manager and stuff. So that you could see why they were going for the formula of, you know, let Test kind of come in hot and then get worked down, have a little bit of a hope spot and then go down. It's sort of a formula. So I kind of get that. And as a match in a vacuum, it kind of makes sense. So to me, it's like a 2.5-star, pretty solid, you know, basic enough match between two guys who, you know, and Test's offense looks pretty good. He's not a complete, you know, slouch or anything. But as you said, Ben, it's sort of like the booking. Is it the best booking? You know, maybe you want Brock to be a little more dominant. And it's not to say like Test can't get anything, but I agree with you. I would have had Brock control the majority of the match, maybe let Test, you know, try and work a comeback and then cut him off. But I agree with you. I don't know if I would have had Test, you know, come in hot from the beginning, like let Brock dominate him in the beginning. Yeah. Let Test maybe try and come back and then squish him. But it's like you said, they can't let go of this, some kind of hope that Test is ever going to be anything, you know?
So yeah, as a match, I went 1.75. It's a fine match. It's, mm-hmm. You know, perfectly acceptable big man wrestling, you know, no mm-hmm. problem at all with that. But the booking for it leaves a lot to be desired. You know, it should be like I'm not going to repeat the point, but it should just be a 2 to 5 minute match. It shouldn't be 10 minutes of 50-50. It should be Brock absolutely beats the shit out of this guy.
Yeah, and I don't think I've said this before because it's something they go to a lot, especially when Brock's facing a guy, any guy who's maybe could be considered a big guy, is the Heyman interference. I don't know if I would have Heyman interfering. No, I don't. It kind of it doesn't. Yeah, it doesn't really fit the character that you've built so far. They kind of go back and forth on it, and it's kind of odd. It's like they can't fully. It's like they're 80% committed to Brock's whole presentation, and then but they can't quite pull the trigger and let it be too dominant. Kind of strange. Yeah,
you could have had that sort of 80s early 90s booking. You know, I'm just thinking of somebody like Jimmy Hart, you know, where Heyman distracts him early in the match and, you know, you play off it. But to have Heyman to, you know, do the distraction and then for Brock to hit the F5 for the win, that doesn't help anybody. None of them three guys are helped by the finish of that match.
Yeah, my comp that I've kind of started on this podcast is comparing the like WCW Vader. And so Vader always had, you know, Harley with him, but Harley Race never really was a guy that would interfere much. He would get his ass beat a lot by the faces who would just get a hold of him, beat him up. But it was, I didn't feel like it was a big thing with Vader for Harley to really play much of a factor in him winning. It was just, you know, Harley was just kind of his, you know, corner man sort of thing. Yeah, and I feel like they should play it a little bit more like that.
Off the top of my head, I could think of sort of two matches he interfered with in the for the win, and you know, two matches in a 2.5 year run is you know, that's pretty acceptable. But you know, this, I mean, how many matches is this now where Heyman's done this in just 2 or 3 months?
Yeah, it's true. They're making it a pretty regular part of their shtick, kind of, and it's a little questionable, but. As it were, so that sets us up. So we get the RVD Brock final, which is definitely a cool final on paper. And they've kind of hinted at this. He and Brock have had a stare down like on Raw before. And you have the Heyman history with RVD being ECW. So it's a pretty cool pairing, I think, for a final. Like I said, the early rounds of this tournament were kind of blah. It was what it was. It was just an ends means to an end. But I think this final four was, you know, solid enough for what it was.
Oh yeah, yeah. RVD is sort of the final boss that, you know, Brock has to get through. He's, you know, he's faced the Hart. You know, he's gone from Spike to the Hardys to your favorite Bubba. Now it's going to be RVD, and you know the main event is the next level. So RVD being that bridge is perfectly acceptable.
Yep. And you just mentioned him, so we head backstage and Coach is with my favorite Bubba, who says, and he asks Bubba for whatever reason who he thinks will be King of the Ring, and Bubba says that he does not see RVD winning, that it's just RVD's great, he's a great fighter, blah blah blah, but he thinks that Brock is just too much to handle. It was a very, very like white meat babyface promo from Bubba, and that seems to be what they're trying to push on him.
bit of foreshadowing for later for Bubba, but yeah, it was it was apart from that little nugget, it was totally pointless.
Yes. So we'll carry on. We get another interview backstage with Lance Storm and Christian. And Lance Storm is obviously very upset that we have instead of having the all Canadian final that they dreamed about, we have a no Canadian final as both Canadians have been eliminated. Christian chimes in and says that this proves the prejudice that they have to Canadians, and basically they start ranting and then say the entire world hates America, which given the time that we're speaking about this, it's interesting to hear the quote. But, anyway,
the more things change, the more it stays the same.
But anyway, so this was just continuing to push Storm and Christian in this sort of Canadian anti-American sort of gimmick that they're starting to put together.
Yeah, it was a nice little Easter egg, and again, more foreshadowing of things to come down the line.
Yep, fine enough. So we head to, which is a very odd thing on these early brand split shows, to where now we go up to the balcony where Cole and Taz are, and so they're hyping the cruiserweight match that's coming up. But they're not going to actually call it. They're in the building. Yeah. This is a SmackDown match. they have microphones. They're there, but they're not going to call the match. But they kind of set up the storyline. Cole calls Nydia a vengeful witch, which is interesting. And then we get a video package to recap the feud between Hurricane and Jamie Noble. With all the letters that were being sent to the Hurricane, it was revealed that was Nydia, so on and so forth. I really have enjoyed Jamie Noble. I just love anytime he speaks. Like, I'm Jamie Noble, boy. Just very entertaining.
He embraces the redneck.
Yes. I'm assuming this is what everyone in the UK just assumes. every American is just basically Jamie Noble.
Every Southern American is Jamie Noble, yes. in much the same way every Brit is Harry Potter and all that, yes.
Yeah. But I don't mind Jamie Noble. He's entertained me so far.
I'm glad you mentioned the announcer thing, because I did make that note. Like, I don't know how you felt about it. So, like, I know it took him a couple of months to do the split commentary team, but if you're working around it, just have one from each show on. So, you know, JR and Taz or Cole and King, and do it that way.
To me, it's just weird to have them. I mean, to me, it's weird to not have them do commentary, but especially it's weird to show that they're there, because then you're reminding me. It's like, maybe it would have slipped my mind and I maybe wouldn't have noticed that they should be on commentary. But when you show them to me, I go, in my brain, I go, oh man, they're here. Like, oh yeah, they should be doing commentary. It's just odd to have them there and not do it, you know?
You just get them sort of WrestleMania 17 with the WCW wrestlers in the Skybox flashbacks here. Oh yeah, there's Taz and Cole. Hi, boys.
Yeah, they couldn't even get on the floor. Yeah, but anyway, so we have Hurricane versus Jamie Noble for the Cruiserweight Championship. Hurricane is our champion. Again, I've enjoyed the Jamie Noble character so far. He's pretty fun. We kind of your typical cruiserweight start. They hit a few little spots and kind of work the mat a little bit. I like Jamie Noble's strikes at the beginning. I thought his strikes look pretty good. And early on, Nydia establishes herself as a factor. She tries to grab Hurricane, but Noble nails him with a clothesline. That looked pretty damn good. I enjoyed that clothesline. So now Noble's on top. Starts working over a Hurricane. And I wasn't sure, Ben, I don't know if you caught this, but I think we got a She's a Crack Whore chant here.
Yeah. It's got that. Yeah. The exact note I have is, she's a crack whore chant for Nydia that even the King has to note.
Yeah, it was. So that was, you know, obviously has not aged well. probably wasn't great at the time either. But anyway, we carry on. Hurricane tries to work his comeback with a sleeper, but then Jamie Noble counters with a jawbreaker. Hurricane manages a reverse neckbreaker to kind of get himself back in it. He hits kind of I called it like a blockbuster-esque sort of maneuver to get a near fall. They look pretty good. And so at this point, we kind of get into the point in the match where we're just kind of trading near falls. Eventually, Hurricane grabs his cape, but Nydia steals it back, because that was part of the story, that they had stolen his cape and Nydia has it. Noble takes a suplex outside and hits his leg on the apron, which I thought was a pretty good-looking spot. I thought that looked really good. We get a crossbody out of the ring by the Hurricane. That looked good, too. Nydia distracts again, which allows Noble to get back on top and take advantage. They fight up on the top rope. Hurricane hits a top rope near neck breaker, but Nydia distracts the ref, which allows, so he cannot get the pinfall. Hurricane throws Noble into her. He hits the choke slam, but Noble kicks out. And so I thought that was a good spot to, because it is a finisher, but it's not the strongest finisher in the world. And it does establish Jamie Noble as kind of a threat, as somebody new that he can kick out of a finisher like that. So I didn't really mind it. We get a nice snapping power bomb by Noble, and Nydia pushes Hurricane's foot, which is on the rope, pushes off so he cannot get the foot on the rope to stop the count, which allows Jamie Noble to win and become the new Cruiserweight champion. I thought this was solid. It had some cool spots and stuff. Nothing spectacular, though. It definitely felt like the first in a series of matches or in a feud. And it didn't, to me, have... Like I said, it was a good match, but it didn't feel like a cruiserweight title match to me. It felt like a match with maybe a few cruiser moves in there, but it didn't quite... you know, and maybe this is my own expectations of, you know, what I think a cruiserweight match is supposed to be or whatever, but it just didn't have that sort of feel of athleticism that I expect when you say like cruiserweight title. Like, you know, I feel like if you wouldn't have told me this is a cruiserweight title match and I just watched the match, I would not, it wouldn't peg it for that, you know. But as it was, I went 2.5, solid. Again, nothing to write home about, but also nothing, you know, it wasn't crappy either.
I went 2.5 as well, and I have exactly the same note as you. So it was my exact note. The note reads WCW Cruiserweights doing a WWF style match, and it doesn't really work. So that spot with, and I think you saw it a little bit, that spot with the swinging net breaker off the top, that should have been the finish. That was a fantastic move. So the second half of this match I really enjoyed, but the first half of that sort of slow and plodding, they had, you know, they were fighting up from that point. So I've got no problem at all with Noble being the champion of the title, but maybe if you're going to throw in that swinging net breaker spot, he should not be winning the title here.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's like, I don't mind him winning either. It established him as strong. It kind of allows the feud to go on. I didn't mind Nydia interfering. But like you said, it's sort of like they do a few. There's some spots in here where you could see like, oh, man, that's like you said, the top rope neck breaker. Even the when he does the blockbuster looking thing, that looked pretty cool. And even when Noble hits his leg on the apron, I thought that was really cool, too. That's the kind of stuff I wanted to see maybe a little bit more of, like really get over the athleticism. And because, like you said, a lot of it felt like your typical, you know, a lot of it felt like a Raw match, like a 1.5-star, like dime a dozen match you see on every single Raw and SmackDown during this era.
Because, I mean, I'm not sure when you started watching, but you know that these two are very familiar with each other through the, you know, from watching them in the dying days of WCW. So you know the kind of match they could have, and we're not saying here go, you know, balls to the wall like they did in WCW, just spot, but you don't need to go punch kick all the time either. You know, there's quite a nice median to hit in there between the two styles, but everything from that blockbuster spot I thought was great. So you had that whole bit on the outside as well where Helms hits the crossbody, you know, Nydia's out there interfering, you know, that little baseball slide drop kick was great as well. Like you say, the second half of the match was really good. They were just fighting from that, you know, really bland first part of the match.
Yeah, it was very much, you know, the critique is what you feel like it could have been as opposed to it necessarily being bad or anything like that, for sure. But so Nydia is obviously overjoyed. So she jumps Jamie Noble's bones at the end. They start making out.
The trailer was rocking that night.
Yes, as we're told, the trailer's going to be rocking because I'm Jamie Noble. So. So fine enough, we head backstage and we get Eddie, who's cutting a promo. So he's going to be facing Ric Flair soon. He shouts out his family, his brothers, his cousins, and also he shouts out little Timmy, whoever that is. He says he's in his prime and Flair can't do what he does what he can. Flair can't do what he do. One run, and he says that Flair wants to have one more run, and the only run he's going to have is into a retirement home. I thought this was a good fired up Eddie heel promo here before the match.
Really good promo. I like you say, I love the whole mentioning all the brothers, the cousins, little Timmy. Yeah, really good fun. Really good fun.
Yeah, it had a nice mix of like seriousness and silliness to it that I think heel Eddie is perfect at.
Yeah, because he was blending in the seriousness with the whole, he was doing the whole Latino heat thing on Terry, and yeah, it was a lovely mix. Lovely mix.
Yeah, and it really sets up sort of the story of the match, of which is definitely, it's a thrown together match too, because it's really based on, it's like Flair having to take Austin's spot now. So in a matter of a couple of weeks, they were, you know, Flair and Eddie were aligned and now Austin left and now they're feuding. So they had to really throw this together. And I thought me and Sean talked about it when he came on, when it kind of, they started building this, that they did a pretty solid job considering they had to just throw this together. And it doesn't hurt when you have two all-timers, you know.
Exactly. So, you know, they only had that one little interview segment on Raw, didn't they, on your last show. But when you've got two masters of the craft who know exactly what they're doing, exactly the kind of mannerisms and lines to pull out. Yeah, they can get things over in 2-3 minutes that most guys would take 20-30 to do.
Yes. So we have Flair versus Eddie. So like I mentioned, this is stemming from, you know, Eddie kind of turning on Flair after Austin's departure, as Eddie blames Flair for Austin leaving and him kind of, I guess, losing his chance to face Stone Cold. So so in the early going, Flair can't get up on Eddie. He can't get an advantage on Eddie. And so Eddie keeps on taunting him. And so I really like this from the beginning, that they're already establishing the story is it's kind of sort of the youth versus the veteran sort of thing, that Flair can't really get anything on Eddie because Eddie's too quick. He's too athletic. Flair finally gets a hold of him and cracks him for a really nice pop. Eddie fires back on him with the strikes and the chops, kind of giving Flair a little bit of his own medicine. So Flair responds with his own. So after Flair gets the chops in, Eddie kind of bails in frustration, sort of does the heel stalling for just a minute. Then he comes back in and again sort of starts doing Flair's sort of own mannerisms as he goes for Flair's knee and starts working over again, like in a very Flair-esque banner. We get a nice roll-up by Flair to try and break Eddie's momentum, which I thought was a really awesome spot. Just like classic Flair stuff, like, you know, him being crafty and trying to, in, you know, kind of put the kibosh on Eddie's momentum. He puts Flair's legs into the post. Eddie locks in a figure four. And at one point, so because Eddie is using Flair's move, at one point, I think JR said that it was a feather in his sombrero, which I thought was an odd line. You know, you could just say cap, just because he's Hispanic doesn't mean it has to be a sombrero. But anyway, Flair tries to push Eddie's foot off to try and break the figure four, but to no avail. But then Flair finally gets the ropes. Eddie works in a headlock, and I really liked, again, I'm not a big fan of King, but on the real, like, the real matches on here, I'll say, or the, as Tim, our good friend Tim would say, the real matches on this show, I thought they did a good job. King did a pretty good job on commentary of actually, like, giving commentary on the match, and he says here that this could be a mistake that Eddie, you know, he just had Flair in the figure four, and now he puts him in this headlock and kind of slows it down a little bit, and that this is going to give Flair enough time to recover. And sure enough, it does. His Flair is able to dump Eddie, so he gets a little bit of a respite period to recover. Eddie comes in again, knocks Flair down. He goes for the frog splash, but he kind of stalls a little bit, and his cockiness makes him miss it because he waits a little bit too long, and Flair is obviously crafty, so he gets out of the way. Flair goes in, tries to work in the figure four as we see Chris Benoit walk down. He gets the figure four on. Eddie kind of reverses a little bit. We get a nice series of pinning combinations. We get a big DDT from Eddie, but Flair gets the ropes. Eddie is just relentless on Flair at this point, just beating the piss out of him. And then finally, Benoit pulls Flair out and locks in the crossface as Eddie distracts the ref. The ref comes out. He ejects Benoit. And while this is happening, Bubba Ray comes out for some reason, hits the Bubba bomb on Eddie, and Flair wins. And that is how we finish this match. I will let you speak because I need a minute to compose myself as I think about Bubba interfering in this match.
Okay, so ending aside, I loved this match. I absolutely loved this match. The thing I loved most about it is right at the beginning, you could tell, you know, how nervous Ric Flair was. I know he mentioned it on DVDs and interview segments he's done on the network about, you know, how he had no confidence in himself in 2002. And you can see that. You can see that in this match right at the beginning. But, you know, he's got the perfect dance partner with Eddie. Eddie carries him superbly. And Eddie at this time, you know, is the in-ring technician that he is. He is absolutely brilliant. You know, that's not just... It's not just saying that, you know, with 20 years hindsight, you know, it's there for all to see. I love the whole youth versus experience, but it was using experience with the added angle of Eddie was basically copying Flair, you know, right into, you know, focusing on the leg, using the figure four, Yeah, he was trying to do all of Flair's mannerisms whilst being the cocky youth, and I really, really enjoyed that. Yeah, the ending, you know, there was no need for Bubba to come out. They could have had Flair win. They could still have had Flair win without Bubba being there. There was no need for that. But yeah, really, really enjoyed this. I went 3.5 on it, so I gave it the same rating as I did the opening match. But you know, this was personally my match of the night because of the story surrounding it, and you know, you could see Ric Flair visibly growing confidence throughout the match, and that was all down to Eddie Guerrero.
Yeah, it was just, I agree with everything you said. I really enjoyed this one, aside from the finish. Like you mentioned, all the way they worked in the story. I thought Eddie did like a perfect combination of sort of being a cocky heel and sort of being a relentless heel, kind of beating the shit out of Flair, because he never pushed the cockiness to a point where it was unbelievable and he looked like an idiot or anything. He did just enough where it fit his character. And it fits perfectly that anytime he would become a little bit overconfident, that Flair is exactly the guy who's going to take advantage of that. It escalated perfectly, which is always something like I love about Flair matches. It's just the way everything just builds so well. There's so many good little spots thrown in. Like, it's just such a small thing, but when Eddie is kind of has all the momentum and he just pulls out that random roll up just to try and cut Eddie off a little bit. Stuff like that I love. Like you said, Eddie trying to, like, you could tell Eddie's trying to prove a point that he can do. And it even goes back to his promo that basically he's trying to say he's a better version of Flair, that Flair's old and Eddie, you know, Eddie's the guy that's now. Just all that was so good. And it's just disappointing that it had to end like that, because I mean, I cannot imagine. It's not just because I don't like Bubba. It just felt so random and just like shoehorned in.
There was no need for, you know, the Benoit interference was enough. There was no need for any other interference in this match. Like you say, there were so many little bits in the match that we were, you know, how many chop wars did we have in this match? You know, Eddie's poor chest. JR even mentions that on commentary, how red raw he is. And going back to something you just said, it was wrestling with a point, wasn't it? You know, it wasn't, you know, we weren't using chin locks and headlocks to be wrestling. These were holds that were holds instead of rest holds. And I hope everybody at home knows the distinction I'm trying to make here. But everything flowed perfectly. Like I say, Eddie definitely carried and led the match, but Flair, you know, once he got that confidence going, was with him every step of the way.
He is a great face too. I mean, considering Flair was a heel like a month ago, and that here he's just playing a really awesome face. Like we said in the onset of this match, just it's a testament to these guys and, you know, the kind of performers that they were able to just go in and get this over before. Yeah. But yeah, I agree. I went 3.5 on it. And I think that it could have even been, I think as is, it's still, I would consider sort of hidden gem territory, because this is not a match I don't feel like I've heard a ton about. Like, it's not one I hear brought up a ton. Maybe I'm not listening enough, but I don't hear this one talked about enough. But to me, this is sort of a hidden gem. Besides the finish, and maybe people soured on it because the finish does suck, but I hate to penalize the two guys in there for that stupid finish when they did so much good stuff leading up to it. But yeah, it was just real shoehorned. And I don't know, if you want Flair to win, there's gotta be some better way. It's just trying to put Bub in there so he looks like somebody who's on the same level of these guys. It's not, it has the opposite effect. It makes me not like him, you know?
Well, you think about everything that Eddie's done since he's come back. You know, let's go 2002 to 2003, just use that year. You know, there's the Edge series, there's the Los Guerrero stuff and the RVD stuff. So yeah, you're right, you tend to forget about this match, because compared to them, those three, you know, that those three are sort of hitting 4 stars regularly, which this doesn't do. But the character work from both is, you know, unparalleled for this time period.
Yeah, very good stuff. But you definitely get a feeling that it's going to continue, and I guess we'll see if it does later on down the line. But as it were, we head actually to WWE The World, formerly WWF New York, in Times Square, where we have William Regal and his new protege, Chris Nowinski, and they rag on the waitress at The World because they ask her where she goes to school, and she says she goes to community college. And so obviously they looked down on her because Nowinski went to Harvard, and that's about it. It's just, you know, sort of like the Lance Storm and Christian stuff. It's to remind you of like these sort of budding characters and angles, just to give them a quick few seconds on pay-per-view.
I mean, Regal's Regal, but I know Nowinski's only just come into the company in that, but he's basically just got the Harvard thing, and literally that's it. You need a little bit more than that.
Yeah, for sure. But anyway, our next match will be our women's title match between Molly Holly and Trish, which has centered more recently around the idea that Molly has a big ass, unfortunately. That means unfortunate. It's not unfortunate that she has a big ass. It's unfortunate that that's what the feud is based on at this point, because they really, I thought, had a good start to this, but I won't, you know, moan and groan about it too much. I've talked about it before. So we start off, we get an early advantage from Molly when she hits some strikes. She's throwing Trish by the hair, that sort of thing. And everything I said about the commentary, like in the previous matches, you can throw it all out the window for this one, because the commentary on this match is just terrible. Just really awful. Like, they're talking about, King's talking about how Molly needs lipo. I mean, it's just terrible here. But carrying on with the match, she's working Trish's arm. She puts in a pretty solid arm bar right here. Trish kind of counters, hits a victory roll to finally get some offense and get things going. But Molly hits a drop toe hold on her, hits her into the rope. And then, so again, they're trying to work this match, and King is on the side saying, JR says something about her like hitting her face, and King says something like, "Well, I'm not worried about the face. What about the puppies?" And so he just will not let this die. So Trish gets thrown out the ring. Trish kicks Molly in the face, and then she puts Molly out of the ring. Molly tries to make her way back to the top, but Trish lays in some kicks, I think it was, to knock her back out. Trish does the handstand Rana, kind of one of her signature spots, though it did not look super great on this one. She didn't really get her snug in between her ankles, sort of. And when Molly flipped, it just didn't look very smooth. A lot of times it does look really good, but this one wasn't the greatest one. Trish gets some strikes. Molly uses an eye rake. We get a belly-to-belly for a near fall for Molly. Molly goes for the Molly go-round, which is her new finisher based around her buttocks, which does not work in this case because she misses it. But she does finally get a reversal and a roll-up and holds the tights to win the title. I thought this was a solid enough match. I think you could definitely see it being much better about the stupid stipulation. I mean, not stipulation, but the stupid story behind it. If they just allowed this to be a feud on two contrasting characters, you know, and allowed Molly to be a little bit more aggressive like she's shown in certain aspects. But I think if this match had a little bit more structure to it and a little bit more of a story going on, like, there were some good spots, but I thought it just needed a little bit more kind of selling and building to really build the stakes. It just felt a little bit disjointed at times. They work well together. You know, at points, I just didn't think it came together much as it just kind of felt like them going from one spot to the next, as opposed to anything that felt super cohesive, but it's still pretty good. I think they work well together, and I just feel like there's such a seed of like a better feud in this, you know, where if they really had more of a blood feud and they really had a little bit better match and it wasn't about all this stupid stuff about Molly having a big ass and all, I feel like this could have been a lot better between these two, because I really do think they're talented. But as it was sort of a 2-star okay match for me.
So I know you've done Croc and Roll same as I have. So the reason I brought that up is because there's obviously one of the big things they were doing and was the whole Dusty Rhodes and Baby Doll and the way he was treating women. And it's good to see that 17 years later that things have really improved in that regard. This is one of those matches that would have been a lot better with the commentary turned down. Mm-hmm. I do think this was probably the first match where people in the back sort of realized that Trish was actually, as well as looking pretty good, she was going to be pretty good in the ring. Helped that she had a great dance partner with Molly with her. Like you say, this was a good chapter one, I think, in this feud. You know, there was definitely more to come from these two ladies. I also went 2 stars. It was perfectly acceptable wrestling, but the commentary was awful. I mean, you know, King trying to start that "she's a fat ass" chant up. Just shut up, man. Just there's just no need for it at all.
Well, especially too, when I feel like maybe the major weakness of the match is them sort of doing some cool stuff, but maybe it not all fitting together into anything coherent. I feel like if you had commentary that was at least trying, you could have maybe helped them out in that regard. And maybe even if the match itself is maybe not looking like the most, you know, cohesive thing, you could at least try and piece it together in commentary. When the commentary is actively just talking about dumb shit, it's definitely not going to do the match any favors.
Yeah. When you're actively burying one of the competitors in the match, you also become the winner and the champion. There's a bit of an issue there. You know, you could Molly's got a perfectly acceptable character, you know, with the whole Virginia thing and, you know, thinking she's prim and proper and better than everybody else because she's a virgin and she hasn't, you know, she hasn't sullied herself yet. That's perfectly acceptable, but there's no need for the body shaming, you know, even in 2002.
Yeah, it's really dumb. It's like they shot themselves in the foot with this feud because it was a pretty solid feud and they just had to swing it this way for whatever reason. But
you know, I mean, I know Vince has got this fetish about, you know, blondes, you know, with, you know, nice legs and big boobs. But you know, if somebody hasn't got that, then it's still perfectly acceptable. You know, she's still a very good wrestler and this is a perfectly acceptable wrestling match. You know, we don't need any of this shit.
Yeah, absolutely. But anyway, we'll carry on. We head backstage and we have Kurt, who is getting ready for his match with Hulk Hogan. He's offended at the idea that he and Hogan are both considered American heroes because he is a true American hero and Hulk Hogan is not. He says Hogan became a hero because Vince said he was. He said he could have been a zookeeper. It could have been whatever. And Vince would have made him a star because it was all Vince. And I even like that because it's just throwing more fire on the Vince Hogan feud that they're starting to build a little bit here. And so I thought that was a good way for like Kurt to sort of mention and put some heat on that feud, starting to build that story that Vince kind of made Hogan, that sort of thing. So I thought that was pretty cool to see that sprinkled into this promo. And he says that Hogan will tap like Bojangles on speed. So another kind of like the Eddie promo we got earlier. I thought this is a good pre-match promo from Kurt with all the stuff about, you know, that Hogan could have been a zookeeper and Vince would have still made him a star. He's not a true American hero.
I literally spat my drink out when he said that zookeeper line. That was it's one of the great things about Kurt Angle that I know pretty much a lot of people say it's one of the things I love most about him is the way he can go from serious to goofy in the same interview. It's one of those very rare talents that you don't see that often. And that's why he had the career he had. You know, the bit at the end where he does the "it's true, oh, it's true, it's red, white and blue true." It's just little things like that. He's got, mm-hmm. you know, he's got the characters so down. You know, this is one of those, I know everybody always mentions the Kumbaya interview and things like that, but this is one of those hidden gem interviews that I totally forgot about. But that zookeeper line should be brought up all the time when people are talking about classic Kurt lines, and it never does.
Yeah, he has gems all throughout all of his promos. And I agree with you, like the way he can switch. And it's just, I think the thing is he makes it seem so natural. It never comes off as sounding forced. He sounds like he comes off like he is that character. That's really who he is. And it never sounds forced. It never seems like he's trying to force the humor. It comes off as very authentic. And I don't know if it's just because maybe it reflects who he is or he's just really good performer, but it's awesome. It's believable.
The best characters are the ones who use their real life personalities dialed up to 11, and Kurt certainly does that.
Yep. So carrying on, so the match he was talking about, we have Hulk Hogan versus Kurt Angle. And like we mentioned earlier, this is another one that I thought was very weird that we don't get Cole and Taz calling this, because this is something that's really been built up on SmackDown. It's very much got a lot of story behind it, but it's so it's weird to have JR and King calling it. So Kurt still has on his wig, helmet combo. And so they lock up to start. Hogan has the strength advantage, as you would probably expect. He tosses Kurt. Kurt comes in, puts Hogan in a wrist lock, and they sort of reset a little bit. Angle lays in some strikes and a clothesline, but Hogan again tosses them. And so Hogan starts hammering him on the outside, follows him out there and beats on him. Hogan comes back in and tries to sort of peel off the headgear a la like a luchador. This is what I keep comparing this to. With him with his headgear, it's like a luchador with their mask. It's like Kurt's wig. And like you see in a sort of in a luchador match sometimes, Hogan tries to sort of rip off the headgear. But he's not able to. Angle lays in some more right hands. Hogan fires back on him. And at this point in the match, I'm feeling like they're still sort of in first gear. It's still a little bit slow, kind of still in that first act. We hit a back suplex. It almost made it seem like... Kurt was going for, normally he would hit a German there, but probably Hogan can't take a German. So he has to switch it to the back suplex, you know, to ease Hogan in a little bit more because he doesn't want to, you know, shatter Hogan's neck or have Hogan just flop on top of him because he can't elevate enough. But anyway, Hogan counters it and Kurt and hits his own suplex, but Kurt slaps on a sleeper off the ropes. We get the good old raise the hand up three times and keep it up on the last one spot from Hogan when he's in the sleeper. Then he gets his own sleeper on Kurt, but Angle suplexes out of it. We get an Angle slam, but Hogan kicks out of it. Hogan starts to Hulk up. So we get a nice little moment where you get the a face-off between basically like the trunks down, the straps down by Angle, and then Hogan hulking up. So both of them kind of like there, because I guess the straps down is kind of like Angle's closest thing to a Hulk up. So they're kind of going at each other like that. Hogan hits the big boot, which allows him to finally rip off the wig. So that really pisses off Kurt. He pops up and bails, threatens to leave the match because he got his bald head exposed. Hogan puts the wig on, which really sets Kurt off. And so this is at the point where Kurt decides he's not going to leave. He's going to go in and kick Hogan's ass. He grabs a chair. He runs in and does the classic bounce the chair off of the ropes, hits himself in the face spot that Kurt does from time to time. And so when he falls, Hogan goes for the leg drop in a really awesome spot. I really love this spot so much. Hogan goes to the leg drop and Kurt pops up and locks him in the ankle lock and taps out Hogan clean after Hogan struggles, tries to power out, but he taps him out clean for the win. I'll let you speak, give your comments on this one first, Ben. What do you think?
Thank you. So I went 2.75 stars on it. So you could compare this match to the Eddie Flair match. So yeah, I preferred that match, but I will say this match had much better crowd heat around it. And I think that's the Hogan act sort of, it's still powering through even, you know, 3 months on from WrestleMania and all that. They're still riding that train as hard as they can. I had to check that end segment again, just to make sure there wasn't a botch egg, so the timing that Kurt has, like you say, from this, you know, to get out the way of the leg drop and then slap the ankle lock on, I thought was great. Kurt basically almost wrestled himself because he did. Mm-hmm. He did such a great job wrestling, you know, with Hulk's limitations. I think that's probably why I preferred the Flair match, because at least Flair could still go a little bit. Hulk, you know, was basically relying on a lot of 80s shtick in this match. You know, like you say, like the whole finger waggle during the sleeper spot. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, the crowd are eating it up with a spoon, but, you know, does it necessarily fly in 2002? Probably not, if you're being honest, but it you know, it's what it is. And Hogan's, probably the most over man in the crowd. So who am I to say that it was wrong?
Yeah, I definitely think they, like you said, they sort of made up for Hogan's limitations with, you know, storytelling and, you know, having this, you know, signature spots, the Hulk versus the strap down, stuff like that. Saying it around Hogan trying to pull off the wig and that sort of stuff. Like you said, just pretty much doing anything you can to make the match entertaining without having to do a ton of athletic stuff, you know, which is fine enough. I mean, I think they did about as much as you were going to get, aside from, you know, WrestleMania 18, where you just have the perfect environment and the perfect, you know, the perfect storm of things happening. I think you're not going to get a ton more out of Hogan at this point. And so it was fine enough. I went 2.5 on it right down the middle. It was a little bit plotting in the early going, but they kind of, once they started moving into, you know, more of him pulling off the wig and Kurt getting pissed off. And, you know, like, that's what I love too. Even working with Hogan, you know, Angle pulls out this really cool kind of, it makes perfect sense that he would wait for the leg drop and sort of, you know, hook the ankle lock off the leg drop. I mean, It's just, it makes perfect logical sense. It's a good tactical move. My only gripe with this is, since they've been building up this Kurt bald head and the wig stuff for so long at this point, I kind of mentioned it on the TV, but I really wish this would have been a little bit more of him snapping. And I know he does kind of snap a little bit whenever Hogan, you know, puts it on and starts mocking him that way. But I do wish he would have kind of, you know, went balls to the wall and just like annihilated Hogan. Like, I just wish he would have snapped more, that it would have been more of a change in him when he gets the wig knocked off, where he really just goes full ape shit and just destroys Hogan. But as it was, I mean, this is a big win. I know it's Hogan. He's kind of on the downswing now that his sort of nostalgia run as champion's over, but it's still a big deal to tap Hogan clean here. So a big spot for Kurt, who, you know, is definitely a guy in the, you know, since I started this podcast on these shows, it's really, he's done a really awesome job of getting other guys over. Like, he's really elevated Edge in this run. And so it's nice to see him get a big win. You know, no matter what, tapping Hogan is a big deal. I think it does actually mean something.
Yeah. Well, I think off the top of my head, the only other person who's tapped Hogan out was Sting. I mean, you know, I don't even think Luger did. He didn't give up or did he tap out? I can't remember Luger, but like you say, it does not happen that often. So, you know, Hogan still has the name, he still has the cachet value where it works. The whole ripping the wig off thing was, they basically were replaced doing the Hogan big man formula, but instead of the body slam, you had the ripping the wig off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Perfect result as well, you know, totally the right result.
Yeah, I enjoy it. Like I said, maybe not the greatest technically work match, but it was entertaining, and I really liked that finish. That was fun.
Yeah, didn't have to be technically great because I don't think that's in this 2002 run. That's not Hogan's shtick, and it never really has been.
And like you said, the crowd was losing their shit. So
yeah.
Yep. So we head backstage and we have Booker T and Goldust. Tonight, Goldust is dressed up as The Rock, and I said that thankfully it's only his hair that he has painted black, thank God. And so he talks about he and Booker being buds while The Rock sneaks up behind him and does the the reel finally after Goldust does his, you know, impression of Rock doing the finally. So Rock comes, does the finally. The Rock has returned to Columbus, et cetera, et cetera. He chastises Goldust for trying to be like him and says Booker tells him not to worry about Goldust. He's not a threat. Booker T does his own version of the Rock's thing. He says something like never loony, spinneroony, all this, basically does the Rock's, you know, if you smell what the Rock is cooking sort of thing. Goldust attempts to do it, but he kind of trails off and can't get anything other than the gold wearing, oh so daring. And then he kind of gives up on it because he can't think of anything else. Booker says that he's down with Rock. And what Rock's been saying in his promos about, you know, if you want to be here, stay here. If not, you need to get the F out sort of thing. And Goldust is being typical Goldust. And so a running theme through this whole promo is that The Rock just keeps turning around to Goldust and just tells him to stop doing that. Like, stop rubbing yourself, man. What are you doing? which is very entertaining. So Rock says he's here for the title match. He wants to see it. Goldust tells Rock that he has ammunition in his cannon. And so again, this makes Rock say why you got to keep being weird, basically, to Goldust. And he says that Rock tells them that they need to lay the smack down on the NWO. And just overall, I mean, this didn't really have much of a point to it except putting three entertaining guys out there. And just to get basically for Rock to say that he's going to be out watching the title match. But overall, I think this was just a fun promo to have three talented guys who are really entertaining just do a promo, just bullshitting around.
Speaking of spitting my drink out, the I have more ammunition in my cannon line. That was another one that got me. I did make the note. So this show was 2 hours and 40 minutes long, and obviously we'll get to the problems with a certain match later on when it comes to the length. You know, why didn't they on this show, based on the previous week's TV, do like a Book of Goldust X-Pac Big Show match? But then,
yeah.
I say that, but then I think, actually, this bit of time with The Rock was perfect for Goldust and Booker to get their characters over. But, you know, I'm thinking, could you have had your cake and eat it and had the promo and the match? I don't know.
Yeah, it's hard to say. Is it, you know, maybe they wanted to build it more? Or, like, did they not feel that Booker T and Goldust were established enough as a team to be, you know, and it's... I guess, too, it's they're still kind of protecting the NWO pretty well here, especially since Sean's in it now. So maybe they're trying to – I feel like they're still trying to figure out what they want to do with the NWO, especially now they have Sean. But, yeah, it almost – it kind of insinuates that they're about to fight because he pretty much tells them, like, yeah, go lay the smack down the NWO. But apparently he means, like, in general, not necessarily tonight, play the SmackDown on the NWO. So,
well, it just, I mean, you know, the previous week, the X-Pac and Booker both cost each other that the semi-final match, the quarter-final matches. So it would have been a natural match to have at this show. But I'm guessing they thought, you know, they didn't have the time. But they actually did if they'd used the time properly.
Agree. Yeah, I think it would have fit up in the show for sure. Yeah, it wouldn't have been a bad idea. But so now we have our semi-main event, which is going to be our King of the Ring final between RVD and Brock. So we come out, we get a fast start, both of them trading the upper hand early going. We get a great spot as Brock counters, RVD's monkey flip, just kind of instead of flipping, he just catches RVD and it slams him into a power bomb, which though was awesome. And then Brock just starts wearing out RVD completely. He locks in a bear hug. I thought this was not the greatest spot. RVD selling of the bear hug was a little silly at times. He's kind of flailing his arms very cartoonishly at one point. Not the greatest bear hug spot I've ever seen. And while this is going on, the commentary again kind of gets good again whenever they get to something, I guess, that they think is more of a serious match. Like JR says here that he's got to give it to Heyman that he could spot talent. So just a good way to continue to build Brock while this match is going on, you know, while Brock's beating the piss out of RVD, talking about how talented he is that Heyman, even though Heyman's, you know, sort of a scoundrel, that he can spot talent. So back to the match, Brock nails the posts. As he goes to kind of give a kind of a shoulder block into RVD in the corner, and RVD moves, so he nails the post. So now RVD is trying to do the tried and true chop the giant down, going after Brock's legs. He does his top rope kick, his rolling thunder, kind of like his typical sort of comeback arsenal. He goes for the five star, but Heyman comes in and interferes. RVD falls on Brock for a near fall, but then RVD goes back to the top, goes off the top, gets caught, F5, and that will be it. And our Brock beats RVD to become the King of the Ring. Nothing I would consider a classic match. You really didn't have enough time to, you know, to build to anything super special. Like, definitely, you know, these two guys are capable of, but that really wasn't the point of this. I thought it was very well done for what they were trying to accomplish. It sucks for RVD, but I don't think the loss really hurts him considering what Brock's trajectory is going to be in the, you know, the following months after this. I don't think it really hurts him too much. And you had pretty much worked an angle where RVD kind of had sort of an injury going, but it made sense for what they were doing. It puts, I think, you know, they still made it a little bit of a competitive match where RVD didn't just get completely crushed, but it's a decisive win for Brock, sets him up as King of the Ring and the number one contender. Sort of like an ends justify the means sort of match where, you know, you don't want RVD or Intercontinental Champion to go down like this, but he is losing to somebody who's going to be fighting for the world title, and he is fighting more than one match in a night, and you do have Heyman getting involved, so that kind of protects him. So it's not the worst thing in the world, but I would 2.5 on the match again. Not a classic, just sort of a solid, good match that accomplished what it was supposed to do.
Yeah, I went 2.25 on this. Perfectly acceptable wrestling. You know, like you say, they've got that fallback of the fact that, you know, second match of the night. So, particularly in RVD's case, you know, he's already gone 15 minutes. So they didn't have to go for a marathon. It was a perfectly fine sprint. I like the fact in this match, you know, go back to something we talked about earlier on, that Heyman's interference didn't lead directly to the finish. You know, that was a nice spot with the, you know, hanging him up on the top rope and then with him falling back. It was the absolute right choice to be king. You know, RVD's got that Intercontinental title. I know we get the match next month, but I really wish we'd have seen like a proper 2-3 month match feud between these two.
Yep. But yeah, as it were, but it establishes Brock as our King of the Ring and elevates him to number one contender. And also, like you alluded to earlier in the show, Ben, he will be the final King of the Ring as a pay-per-view. So kind of a big last person to win it, I would say, considering where he goes.
I think he definitely falls into that Bret Hart, Steve Austin roll call rather than Mabel and Billy Gunn.
Surely. Now we are getting set for our main event. So we head to Triple H, who is backstage. He meets up with the NWO and they sort of do a hug. It's interesting here because the NWO are definitely positioned as heels and Triple H is still sort of a face. But I guess they're playing on the fact that they're friends in real life and that sort of thing. And Nash tells them that if they need him, they will be there. So kind of an odd sort of, I guess it's alluding to the future sort of, but sort of an odd segment to have here right before the match.
Yeah, just like you say, he was playing the feud going in, playing the face going in. But we all know that they're all friends. So it's one of those, we know that you know that we know segments.
Yep. So we'll see if they...
I was going to say, you know, the internet wasn't quite the all singing, all dancing thing, but most people had already heard about the Click, and you obviously, the fact that the Click spawned the NWO and DX.
Yeah, and I think they just wanted to have that sort of juxtaposition just to put into your head, but we'll see if they play any role if he does use them in this match. But we get our main event, Triple H versus Undertaker for the Undisputed title, which is an interesting match because Taker has been positioned as a pretty solid heel. I've liked the majority of his heel stuff, even if, you know, his matches are inconsistent at times. So we have him as a solid heel, and Triple H, who has through his entire run, you know, some you could probably blame on him and some is circumstance. But I think it's hard to argue that he hasn't struggled to connect as a babyface for a lot of different reasons. This has been, I would call, a solid feud so far. Nothing I would say amazing. They do an extremely long video package to show you what's going on with them in case you didn't know. They have the segment where Triple H kind of beats up the camera and stuff like that and hits announce tables with sledgehammers. So it's been an okay feud. Any thoughts on this as a feud at this point in time, Ben, before we get into the actual match?
I think it's been all right. I think, this 2002 run of Triple H is before, you know, as you come back into the face. It's perfectly fine. It's perfectly acceptable. I do think they kind of rushed it a little bit from Judgment Day to now. They could have, there's only really had sort of those 3-4 weeks of build, and they could have eked out another match with Hogan. But you know, it is what it is.
Yeah, agree. But so we get Heyman coming out on commentary, I guess, because he wants to scout, knowing that Brock's going to be the number one contender. And we get the match started after, you know. And so as you mentioned, Ben, so this whole thing is quite a lot of time because both of these guys, obviously, I mean, Taker's not doing the dead man entrance, but he has a pretty decent entrance. And then Triple H for sure does his full spit in the water. You know, I'm the game entrance, which is incredibly long. It's a really awesome entrance. I'm not going to lie. I mean, you know, I'm not a guy who hates Triple H or loves him, but I do think it's a cool entrance. It's cool music and stuff. So I get why they give him a long entrance. But anyway, we start Triple. And so it's important to mention too, I think, before we get into this. So part of the story of this match is that, you know, especially Triple H, you can see it in the match. His elbow is heavily taped and padded. So he has sort of an elbow injury. I think it's something like he had like bone chips or something like off his elbow or some injury of that sort. And then also I think even Meltzer says that Taker was kind of just dinged up, as Taker, you know, seems to be a common thing with him. I guess it's just the nature of, you know, being the, you know, having the body type he has and how long he's been around, and, you know, he doesn't take a ton of breaks or anything. But he's kind of dinged up here. So both guys are kind of dinged up going into this match. So I think that definitely plays a role in it. But Taker starts off with some strikes. He takes Triple H outside for some more strikes as Heyman is just putting over Brock incessantly on commentary. Triple H whips Taker into the stairs, knocking Taker's knee back in. So they head back in the ring. Taker lays in some more strikes in the corner, and this becomes very much a recurring theme in this match. Heyman points out Triple H's elbow injury, like I mentioned a minute ago. So even on commentary, they're not shying away from that. This is a thing, work into the match. We get some more strikes from Triple H in the corner, and Taker lifts him up, hits snake eyes on him. The crowd is extremely quiet as Taker lays in some more strikes. I mean, there's just no other way to say it. They are extremely quiet. He's laying in strikes on Triple H's lower back here. Triple H tries to work a comeback, but he eats a sidewalk slam. You could tell in this early going, they're definitely trying to go for sort of a kind of a slugfest style of a match. But it's really, I think for that sort of match to work, you really have to get across the intensity. And even by this point in the match, it's really not connecting in that way. You're really not getting, I mean, I don't know if you would agree, Ben, but it's just not... to me, it's not getting over what they're trying to do. The crowd's not buying it. The shots don't look brutal or anything. It kind of just looks like they're going back and forth and punching each other for the most part.
It's just brawling and kicking for the sake of brawling and kicking. There's no point to it at all.
Yeah, it's not being, I don't want to say they're not selling it, because it's really not there, but it's just not coming across with any kind of energy or an intensity. It just kind of feels a little plodding, going back and forth or slugging at each other.
Both guys are running at half speed and are not particularly quick to begin with.
Yes, correct. So Heyman mentions that The Rock is supposed to be here on commentary. We get an apron elbow to Triple H, followed by the patented apron leg drop by Taker. Triple H again tries to get back on top, but Taker cuts him off once again. Finally, Triple H hits a suplex on outside to sort of get a little bit of advantage. We get a very slow top rope superplex, but Triple H cuts it off. They're kind of setting it up, but they're just sort of up there for what seems like a very long time. Triple H starts to kind of rally back with a back body drop. Taker again cuts him off, doing the flying clothesline. Taker unties the turnbuckle. Take a drink. As every heel has to untie the damn turnbuckle.
He's red page eight. Yes.
So Heyman is crapping on The Rock on commentary, like crapping on a little rock. He's crapping on, you know, Dwayne Johnson. So Triple H blocks the turnbuckle as Taker tries to put him into it, but then he ends up eating a clothesline. Taker then gets thrown into the exposed buckle. We get a very weak spine buster from Triple H, where like Taker barely elevates off the ground and looked pretty rough. That gets a near fall. We get another snake eyes. Now Taker actually hits him on the exposed buckle, but then this leads to Triple H coming back. He hits the high knee for a near fall. We get a DDT. Triple H goes for the pedigree. But Taker counters out of and catapults him into the ref, and Hebner's just toast now. Like, I mean, Hebner's just completely out. He looks like he's not going to wake up for about 10 minutes, which is very convenient because the Rock's music hits and he heads out. It, this was just such an odd thing here. So we've already been in this match for what seems like 10 to 15 minutes of really plodding slow, slugging away, kind of just slow, not very engaging match. And then it's so weird to me that Rock's music hits like when he's coming out in the middle of this title match. Like, he doesn't just walk out. You know, it's one thing to come out right now and, you know, during a title match, but to actually have his music, and he does pretty much kind of a full entrance. I just thought it was so strange in the middle of a title match for Rock to just have a full entrance with music and like a crowd reaction was very odd. He chases Heyman off to take a spot at the commentary table. So far the Rock's present has, it's his, not really done a lot to help this boring match. Taker comes out, he gets a chair. Triple H stops it and then throws Taker out of the ring. Taker nails Rock for like absolutely no reason. Like, he just, so he gets thrown out. He just punches the Rock or hits him with a boot or something for like no apparent reason. Rock, I don't even think, says anything to him. So Rock unloads on him. He goes for Taker, but he goes to hit Taker with the chair, but then accidentally hits Triple H with it. So now Triple H is busted open and he eats a last ride. Nick Patrick comes in at this point because Hebner is still unconscious. But Triple H kicks out, and so then Taker gets pissed off at Nick Patrick because he didn't get the win, throws him out. The Rock comes in, hits a rock bottom on Undertaker. Now they're both out. Triple H gets up first, and then he covers Taker, and Hebner gives like the most absurd slow count you've ever seen in your life. It's like he waits a good, like, what seems like 5 seconds between each time his hand hits the mat, just selling the shit out of it. And it's just the kick out here. It's just the crowd really doesn't buy it. They're not invested into it. And there just hasn't been enough going on for you to feel invested in any kind of finish here. So they're going for it. Like, you know, they're trying to go for like them hitting these big moves and like trading off big moves, but it's just, there hasn't been anything up to this point to really get you invested or build to this. Finally, Triple H hits the pedigree, but Earl can't count, of course, because he's still out. We get a weak roll up by the Undertaker, which ends it. We get a three count, and oof, I don't know. Talk about this, Ben. That was so fun.
Okay. I went one star, and I think even that might be generous, to be honest. I've made a list of things I would rather do than watch this match, so I just hope you could humor me just for a sec. So I've got on this list, I would rather listen to a whole Ed Sheeran album, watch an Adam Sandler film marathon, a best of NYC TNA 2004 compilation.
Oof.
Get paper cuts on my tongue, or get a tooth removed without any anesthetic. This, honest to God, this might be the most boring match I have ever watched. You know, when you think sort of, you know, you reminisce and you remember things and think, you know, certain things are a bit cloudy. We saw earlier on two examples of matches that were a lot better than I remember. This. I mean, we spoke, didn't we, off air about how I thought at the time, yeah, this wasn't the greatest, but it wasn't bad. And then I watched it again the other night, and I was like, this is so terrible. It's like you say, they were trying to dramatize the whole match, and there was literally no drama there. When the two most over men in the match are, you know, The Rock and Paul Heyman, that's a bit of an issue. I do think, yeah, they were banged up. They were both injured. And, you know, that's got to be taken into consideration. But there was literally, you know, there was hardly any wrestling moves. It was just all punches and kicks.
And like we said, not even like engaging punches and kicks, you know, because I think there's a way to do that sort of match and make it work. I mean, there's plenty of kind of old school matches that do that and really get you invested in it. But they just felt like slow slugging away, no energy, no intensity to it. It to me, that whole early part seemed like they were just killing time until Rock came out, until they were doing the ref bump. It's like the ref told them, like, okay, 10 minutes, y'all can hit me now. Like,
the frustrating thing is, it's not like a Rock Undertaker situation where these two have anti-chemistry. Mm-hmm. You've seen from their WrestleMania matches, they can go. They both know how to go. You know, they don't even need the Hell in a Cell to have the great sort of intense brawl. But I don't know whether it was just a thing of, you know, obviously this is a couple of weeks after Austin had left, you know, the Rock's only just come back, whether they were trying to show everybody that they are the locker room leaders and we could have this great main event match. And it was just a plodding mess. Like I say, I went one star, and even now I'm thinking I've gone too high.
Yeah, I went the same, and I'm sort of with you. It's odd to me. To me, that's kind of an indictment too, because if you do know both these guys are injured, they know they're injured, then you need to kind of work around that. Don't give them 20 minutes to go out there and do this slow thing when neither one of them can, you know, go do their best. You know, they can't go full speed. So why give them this much time to do this?
If they're both injured, then like you say, you've got these other matches on the card where you can give some time to them. You know, we mentioned earlier on a match that could have been on this show. There's 10 minutes. You know, just give these two a little streak. You know, give these two like a... It doesn't need to be like a Hell in a Cell or anything like that, but a street fight stipulation, you know, that could have worked. But, yeah, they were hiding... You know, I'm not saying hiding is the wrong word, but they had limitations with the injuries. But let's help these two guys out, even if they are two veterans. You know, everybody needs a bit of help sometimes.
And then it makes you think, like you sort of alluded to, did they go out there and say, no, we want 20 minutes, so we're going to go out there and, you know, tough it out and still put on the match because we're the top dogs, and then they go out and, you know, lay a big egg like this?
I think you've hit the nail bang on the head there. It's like, we know what we're doing, damn it. We've got this match laid out. It's going to be great. And it just wasn't.
And the benefit of the Rock stuff, it did at least wake up the crowd, who are really dead for the majority of this. But then the Rock stuff doesn't do it any favors to me, because it just makes it even more disjointed, because you kind of have the first half, which is just a really boring, slugging brawl. And then the Rock comes out, and it just becomes a completely ridiculous, overbooked mess. Because, like I said, it feels very, to me, this whole match felt like they know where they want to go, you know, but we just got to find a way to get there. And so it's going to be painful, but we just got to get this out the way. We got to get Rock involved so Rock can be in the title picture, because we brought Rock back early because, you know, Austin left, so we need Rock to come back early. So now we got to figure out a way to get him in the title picture, have him come out in the main event. Taker's going to hit him for no reason. You know, it's very sloppy. It's sort of like they're just like, look, this is not going to be the best thing we ever did, but we just got to force it through, you know, kind of bite the bullet so we can get to better things down the road. That's what this match felt like to me.
The Rock thing was a distraction, and it was a welcome distraction for the crowd. But like you say, you could feel the crowd was sort of waiting for him to come out, weren't they? It didn't help the fact that on Raw the week before, and even in that Goldust promo, that he promised to come out. So the crowd knew what was going to happen, and they knew that, you know, nothing was really going to happen in this match until The Rock came out.
And I think him coming out, like I said, it was so odd to me that they just hit his music in the middle of the match. Like, to me, I just, instead of having Heyman come out there at all, just have Rock be on commentary the entire time and kind of do the classic, you know, he's jawing with them, finally Taker gets pissed off. Do it like that, you know. It's not the most compelling thing or interesting thing, but it's, you know, it's solid, it works, it's a tried and true method. But to me, it made this already boring match. It just didn't do it any favors by then having a Rock come out and sort of disrupt anything they might have been doing. And then you get all this stuff with Hebner getting bumped, and Nick Patrick comes out, and all this bullshit happens. It just, you know, it was like two sides. It was like in the beginning, not enough happened, and they tried to do too much stuff that didn't really. It didn't. There was not enough in the beginning to lead you to invest you in it for all this. You know, all these spots in the end where Hebner's giving this hyper dramatic slow count thing. It was just a mess. It was to me. It felt very. This to me is a very transitional show, and the main event signifies it because you have all this that you kind of had to you thrown this together, and now you got to figure out. You know, you want to get Rock involved. You know where you want to go for SummerSlam, but you got to find a way to transition to that, and this is a rough way to do it.
Like you say, they were almost going for this sort of epic match, but me as a fan, I'm not emotionally invested in either man at this point because. You know, as your very first question said, you know, they've only been feuding for about a month, so why should I be invested in either of them at this stage?
Yeah. Yeah, just a very disappointing main event to an otherwise, I think, pretty good show.
Absolutely, yeah.
Mm-hmm. But so I should mention, so after the match, The Rock comes out, he hits the people's elbow on Taker. And then Triple H comes out. He hits the pedigree because he's pissed off that Rock hit him with the chair. And then finally close it out. Taker gets back up. He hits the chokeslam on Triple H. So if nothing says triple threat, I know this might not be where it works out, but it definitely seems like what they're insinuating here. I mean, what says triple threat more than every guy going in around Robin and doing their finishers to each other? I could hear the crowd. Should be screaming triple. If this happened today, I could hear the crowd screaming triple threat.
Yeah, I mean, like you say, well, I think Triple H took that time off and Angle took his place in that match. But yeah, it was definitely, they might as well have just put a big neon sign up and said, yes, you're getting a triple threat next month.
Yes. But anyway, that's how we close up the show. So we'll get to our overall thoughts. So we've kind of been getting to it as we spoke about the main event. And it's very important to mention the whole package of the main event takes up a good 30 to 40 minutes, I would say. If you count the entrances and everything around it, the post-match stuff, it is a good chunk of the show. And I think that is the biggest weakness, obviously, on the show, that the main event is basically like an anchor weighing the show down. Because otherwise, I was pleasantly surprised by this show. I thought it was kind of sneaky good in a way. Nothing amazing or anything, but really nothing besides even the Trish and Molly match. I don't think it was some horrible match. It was just the commentary, you know, it was just an okay match with really bad commentary. But otherwise, I mean, you have the opener, which is really awesome. I really enjoyed Flair Eddie. And even the other stuff in the King of the Ring was good. It made sense. Brock being elevated and winning, you know, is a cool moment. You know, and I thought all that was solid, except for that main event. And it definitely, I think, it kind of sets the stage for the summer, I think, this show. Like I said, it feels very transitional, and you kind of see where we're going with the summer. You see Brock being elevated. You see The Rock coming back, and he's going to be involved in the title picture. So you're kind of seeing all these things getting set into motion. But it definitely feels like everything's in flux, and they're trying to channel everything into where they want to go next. So I struggle with the rating on this because it really all comes down to how much do you want to penalize it for the main event. And, you know, you can't just write it off because it's your main event. It's your title match. It takes up a huge chunk of the show. I ended up settling on a 6 out of 10 on it, which may be generous considering, you know, you have a 1-star crap main event. But I really, really enjoyed the show to that. It was really fun.
Yeah, I was thinking similar to you, to be honest. So if you take everything up, if you've been listening along, everything up to the main event. So I think the lowest score that both of us have given a match so far is 1.5. So that tells you that everything on this show up to the main event is at least watchable or short. So it's not going to be, you know, this show is, you know, perfectly good wrestling. It's a great way of spending 2 hours. You know, there's a couple of really good matches on there, some angle advice and advancement. Unfortunately, the main event just kills any goodwill that you have towards the show, to be honest. And like you say, it's not particularly, it's not a short match. It's half an hour. It's a genuine half an hour match. And, you know, you do think why and how. So without the main event, I was going sort of 7, 7.5, but with the main event, I'm with you at 6.
Yeah, it makes it. And I think another thing in the undercard too is you have some good variety, you know, because you kind of have the athletic showcase in the opener. Then you kind of get the veteran versus younger guy match with Flair and Hogan, with Angle and Eddie. And then, you know, you get the Cruiserweight match. You get, so there's a good variety, too. The matches kind of all do sort of different things. But, yeah, that main event is an anchor. It's unfortunate because I think if it was at least decent, I think you're looking at sort of a sneaky sort of hidden gem of a show.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, and you know, everything sort of flows on the show. It's, you know, the matches are bang, 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 bang. You know, there's not really a lot of fluff, and the fluff that we do get is there's some really good character work in that. So, you know, there's until you get to that main event, I'd say there was not much time really wasted on this show. And it's such a shame.
Yeah. So I was still, even despite the main event, I was pleasantly surprised. It was it was better than I expected to be going into it. So can't complain too much.
Yeah. You know, it's like say it's a 2-hour, 40-minute show and half an hour of that is that main event. So, you know, that tells you that 80% of the show is, you know, good to really good.
Yep. But on that note, let's head to our award. So best match. I think we both have similar contenders, but I think Jericho RVD edged it for me just by a little bit.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Sort of sentimentality would give it to Flair versus Eddie. That's sort of the match I'm going to remember most from this show. But from a technical point of view, it's, you know, RVD and Jericho is the better match.
Yeah, honorable mention, Eddie Flair. It's a close runner-up for sure. My best moment I had, I was kind of torn because the Brock winning is a big moment, but I don't know if it really, there's really not much of a moment, I think, because they don't really even do the crown and all that shit. So I kind of went with the Rock and Booker T and Goldust promo because it was kind of the most entertaining non-in-ring thing on the show.
Yeah, I also went with the Rock and Booker and Goldust bit, you know, the ammunition cannon and the sick freak just took it over the edge for me. But I've got to give an honorable mention to Kurt and the Zookeeper line. That like I say, that just killed me.
Yeah. And that's another thing. Good promos on this show too. Good, solid, kind of short, entertaining, good promos.
That's what I was saying before. You know, there is, you know, I'm classing a promo as fluff, but it's all, you know, fluff with a, and it sounds awful, like how I'm going to phrase it, but fluff with a point, like you said, it all means something. It's character work or it's building up to a match on the show.
Yeah, for sure. My LVP, so I think you got to give it to one of the, it's almost, you could, I think you could easily do a tie between Triple H and Taker because, you know, injury or not, you can't go out there and put on a stinker like that in the title match. But I'd lean more towards Taker for some reason. I don't really know why, but I think it's kind of like you can go for a tie. Either one of them, I think, would be my LVP.
Yeah. Both of them and Earl as well for some of the worst referee selling that I have seen in a long time.
So absurd. My MVP, I went with RVD because he had two matches. He had the great opener, Jericho, and I thought he was really good in the Brock match, accomplishing the goal of what that match was.
I went, this is our first different of the night. I went with Eddie and Kurt because they were both basically did the same job, you know, that the youngster, you know, helping out the veteran talent and getting a really good, you know, a really good match out of there. I thought they both did their job really well.
Yeah, no argument for me. All worthy candidates. So on that, I'll give my top five of the night. So my top five, which kind of goes with your MVPs, I had Angle, RVD, Brock, Jericho, and Flair, but I could easily put, I think, Eddie in place of Brock. I think I picked Brock more because it is a big night for him, though I would say Eddie probably gave a better performance in his match, so I could definitely see Eddie.
Yeah, I went Brock because of winning the King of the Ring and what it's going to mean for his future career. RVD, basically for what you said in the MVP bit, you know, for the two matches, he was really good in both matches. So, you know, and like we said right at the beginning, how over is he still at this point? Kurt and Eddie were just super, you know, Eddie in particular was just superb. And also Flair, because like you say, even for the greatest of all time, you know, you could see that man's confidence at the beginning of that match was absolutely shattered. And by the end, he was basically riding Space Mountain again.
Yeah, it's just, man, the star power is just crazy. To think all these guys, like, and pretty much all of them, pretty much in their primes, I would say, or pretty close to their prime. It's kind of amazing.
Yeah. Totally. And, you know, it's so nice as well, this time period, to see the veteran talent be willing, or at least the veteran talent on this show, willing to help out the younger talents. You know, you don't see that often.
Yeah. But Ben, that wraps up the King of the Ring 2002. Like I said, to me, the show feels very, very transitional. We're Brock becoming number one contender, kind of like that mess of a main event is messy because I think they're trying to get to where they're trying to go next, and they're just trying to get there any way that they can. It just feels very much on the heels of Austin leaving, Rock coming back. It feels like we are moving into sort of it's like the true beginning, I feel like, of moving into this next era that they're going into. So it's a really interesting show and a fun one, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's like I said at the beginning, you know, this from this show up to WrestleMania 19, there's very few weak points on the way or unmemorable points, but definitely a transitional show. I think, you know, rightly or wrongly, Triple H and The Undertaker were basically trying to go out and prove a point to Austin. It didn't really come off, but you had the guys behind them, you know, the likes of Kurt, the likes of Brock, who were ready to step up into that main event scene.
Yeah, for sure. They did not prove any point except that they couldn't put on a good main event.
Well, maybe the only point they proved is the fact they maybe shouldn't be main eventing together for a while.
Yeah. But anyway, that wraps us up. Ben, do you have anything that you would like to plug?
We'll just plug a couple of things. So the newest episode of Special Relations on the Place We Nation wrestling feed is out with our special guest, Mr. Tim Capel. We talked all things Halloween Havoc, both the old version and the NXT version, as well as Tim taking about 2 hours to talk through his happy place. It's as overindulgent and as fabulous as you would expect it to be, and Mr. Capel is amazing. There's also a new episode of Chicken Salad that will be out by the time this comes out. We are doing Survivor Series 99, and I don't know if you want to mention a bit more about it, but me and you were also on the latest edition of Making Mount Rushmore on the Pop feed, where we were talking about 90s It Guys and Girls.
Yes,
oh, one more,
we
do. Sorry, one more thing, because he will kill me if I don't mention it. Me and Callum were special guests with Rory on Senior Video, where we live watched the best of the British Bulldog. And it was an interesting show, as interesting as a 10-minute match with IRS can be.
Would you say it was bizarre? Sorry.
He doesn't say that, but he doesn't say that, but he does say Warlord.
Very good. Yes, we were on the Making Mount Rushmore. That was a really fun show. We went to some interesting directions, I would say. besides that, so you and I frequently do Highway to the Impact Zone together, covering 2004 TNA. We're almost on the weekly pay-per-views. God bless us. other than that, also you mentioned Tim. So Tim, Jen, and myself, there should be, by the time this drops, a new PTB NXT. We're a little bit late on it due to, you know, extenuating circumstances. But you should see a new one of those on the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed coming up very soon. Other than that, please check out all the podcasts we have here on the North South Connection feed. We have pretty much wrestling shows dropping every day on ECW, mid-90s WCW and WWE, TNA from the very beginning of TNA with a TNA Never Dies, and also some other podcasts. So we have This Week in the NFL. The NFL is really starting to hit its, you know, stride. We're about mid-season, so check that podcast out. It is the first and I believe only show on the North South Feed sports show that is, and also check out a lot of cool comics podcasts. I'm not the biggest comics guy, but I know the people who are doing them here on the North South Feed, and they're all awesome, and you should check them out. But just say if you listen to this podcast, chances are you know what the North South Feed is. Check it out, listen to whatever tickles your fancy, yeah, I think that will wrap us up, Ben. But it's a pleasure having you. Thanks for staying up late as always that you have to do to be on the podcast. But it was a pleasure. I'm glad I got you have you on for King of the Ring, and I will surely have you back soon enough.
Well, thank you so much for having me and for breaking my North-South virginity. Thank you. It's been a blast.
Yes, anytime. But other than that, this has been another episode of the Ruthlessly Aggressive Podcast. And as Jamie Noble would say, I'm Jamie Noble. Anyway, bye-bye. Hold on that new shit. Niggas like, how come? Niggas want my old shit. Buy my old album. Niggas stuck on stupid. I gotta keep it moving. Niggas make the same shit. Me, I make the blueprint. Came in the range. Hopped out the Lexus. Every year since, I've been on that next shit. Traded in a gold for the platinum Rolex. Now a nigga wrist match the status of my records. Used to rock a throwback, ballin' on a corner. Now I rock a telesuit, looking like a owner. No, I'm not a Jonas, brother, I'm a groaner. No, I'm not a virgin, I use my cojones. I move on with the only direction. Can't be scared to fail, search of perfection. Gotta keep it fresh, girl, even when we sexin'. But don't be mad at him when it's on to the next one. Somebody bring me back some money, please. I got a million ways to get it. Shoe swine. Hey, bring it back, bring it back. Now double your money and make it stack. I'm on to the next one. On to the next. I'm on to the next one. On to the next. I'm on to the next one. On to the next. I'm on to the next one. On to the next. Hold up. Somebody bring me back some money, please. Fuck a throwback jersey, cause we on to the next one. And fuck that auto-tune, cause we on. And niggas don't be mad, cause it's all about progression. Loiterers should be arrested. I used to drink Cristal, them fuckers racist. So I switch gold bottles on to that spaceship. You gon' have another drink or you just gon' babysit. On to the next one, somebody call a waitress. Baby, I'm a boss, I don't know what they do. I don't get drops, I drop the label. World can't hold me, too much ambition. Always knew it'd be like this when I was in the kitchen. Niggas in the same spot, me I'm dodging raindrops. Meaning I'm on vacay, chilling on the big yacht. Yeah, I got on flip-flops, white Louis Vuitton shoes. Y'all should grow the fuck up, come here, let me coach you. Hold up. Somebody bring me back some money, please. I got a million ways to get it. Shoes wine. Bring it back, now double your money and make it stack. I'm on to the next one, on to the next. I'm on to the next one, on to the next. I'm on to the next one, on to the next. I'm on to the next one, on to the next. Hold up. Somebody bring me back some money, please. Big pimpin' in the house now. Bought the land, tore the motherfucking house down. Bought the car, tore the motherfucking roof off. Ride clean, I don't never take the shoes off. Bought the Jeep, tore the motherfucking doors off. Foot out that bitch, ride the shit like a skateboard. Navigation on, trying to find my next thrill. Feeling myself, I don't even need an X-pill. Can't chill, but my neck will. Haters really gonna be mad off my next deal. I don't know why they worry about my pockets. Meanwhile, I had over chilling in the projects. Had out in Bed-Stuy, chilling on the steps, drinking quarter waters. I gotta be the best. MJ at Summer Jam, Obama on the text. Y'all should be afraid of what I'm gonna do next. Hold up. Somebody bring me back some money, please. I got a million ways to get it. Shoes wine. Hey, bring it back, bring it back. Now double your money and make it stack. I'm on to the next one. On to the next.